Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody. This is Janine, and you are listening to Lunch with Loudon. Coffee Talk Radio shows are part of the Coffee Party Be the Media Project. If you'd like to be the media, you can join our team at www.coffeepartyusa.com/volunteer. Let us know you'd like to be a part of this effort. So, welcome. Today we have an interesting conversation based on current events and, frankly, what's been happening in our country powerfully since 2010, and that is violence, denigration, disenfranchisement of women that has been happening, and how that is actually a money in politics issue. If you had a chance to read my blog at coffeepartyusa.com today, you know, I have a lot to say about this, but I can summarize it to begin our show today. Basically, we were all shocked by the news that three women were found in Ohio after 10 years of captivity. And yet, sex slaves and sex trafficking are a huge national issue, such a major issue that Oregon Senator Ron Wyden has been trying to confront this for years, but has had made little or no progress. We were all shocked by the news that an Air Force officer assigned the responsibility of sexual violence prevention was charged with criminal sexual battery. And yet, sexual violence against our women warriors is known and continually more known to be widespread and has prompted much draft legislation, but again, something that's not getting much traction in Congress. We were all shocked when another case of rape involving high school athletes surfaced, but social bullying of the accuser escalated to vilification by CNN and other members of the press, only to have the victim vindicated by judge and jury. Why? Why is it still so easy to slander and disregard women? What is rape culture? How does that translate to politics today? What is the connection, if any, between money and politics? I think it could be as simple as going back to that conservative strategist, the now departed Paul Weyrich. In 1980, he said, "How many of our Christians that I have contact with are involved in the goo-goo syndrome, good government? They want everyone to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of this country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in elections quite candidly goes up as the voting populace goes down." Is it really this simple? Disenfranchised people do not vote. Is the disenfranchisement of women a way to keep us away from having political influence? There you go. So today to discuss this with me is Dennis Little. He's active in transpartisan politics and works to advocate change. He has a background in healthcare system and is currently involved in the renaissance of healthcare technology and the human dynamic aspect of care. Welcome to Lunch with Loudon, Dennis.
Well, Janine, thank you so much for having me today. It's a pleasure to be here, and I welcome the opportunity to speak on this issue.
Right. So we had a wonderful conversation earlier, so I know that in some ways we're on the same page about this. But I know that we have members of our audience who might wonder exactly how extreme or intense or true is the connection between money and politics and the denigration of women. I don't know if you have sort of an opening salvo for us on that one, or.
Well, I find it interesting, as you know, you and I were talking about this last night, and as I did a little more research on it, and just, you know, as I'm processing before I came on today, I was really surprised, you know, as I was going back and doing a little reading and research, as the, you know, we were talking about the 2012 elections and how the process, you know, through part of the country here, especially in Missouri, you know, how the political issue of rape, you know, came up, and how it actually has become a wedge issue and a leverage issue in politics, and that there are actually people out there that will help finance this kind of belief system, you know, for either their own benefit or for the benefit of many. But it really surprises me that the idea that, you know, this issue, sexual rape, whether it be sexual rape or whether it be assault, you know, can be politicized in any way, in a positive way for political benefit. I'm having a really hard time grasping this in our society today, because it seems for the last 40 years, 50 years, we've been working so hard to reverse this kind of behavior in our culture. And now we're watching both on talk radio and in the political spectrum itself a way of shifting it back to a wedge issue. You know, like we've had wedge issues with gods, with guns, with gender issues, orientation issues. You know, this has now become an issue itself, and I'm finding a hard time wrapping my brain around as to why. So it's an interesting aspect.
Well, it did. It was certainly in 2010, 2012, and I believe in 2014 will be an issue. And certainly Mitt Romney's defeat is in many ways attributed to his refusal to look at women's issues or take them seriously. And I certainly have experienced in my world, in the blogosphere and in on Facebook and other social media, that there are quick defenders that want to say, you know, the Constitution guarantees women rights, actually guarantees citizens' rights, and that, you know, it's not obvious to them that there is any kind of discrimination going on, or that there's any social culpability. You know what I'm saying? It's like,
right,
what is the social message that makes us an easy listening for the possibility that a rape victim is lying, or that women in the military should have known what they were getting into, or that everyone who believes, everyone who is pro-choice does not respect life, or is some kind of, you know, streetwalker in need of emergency birth control. I mean, that kind of, it's odd to me that it's possible, but let's face the facts, it's happening now. And I think it really showed up during the recent debates around the Violence Against Women Act, you know, how it was totally unacceptable to include Native American women, transgender people, or illegal, you know, meaning undocumented, that's the word, I'm sorry, undocumented women, into the protections of a law that has historically proven to be very effective in prosecuting sexual crime and sexual violence.
Well, one of the things I think we're watching, and it's becoming more prevalent, we're seeing a lot more of this, is where we're seeing a systematic dehumanizing of women, of race, of orientation, so that, you know, as continuation of the other, you know, they are the others. They are the ones to not be respected and to not hold a place next to us, not to be able to stand next to us. They are less than. And we're watching this in many different places. You know, I will stay on track as to what the topic is today, but we're seeing this in the workplace. We're seeing this in our social life. We're seeing this, you know, people are standing across the street. If they are the other, if they become the other, they become less than, and we start to take away their power. This is, I think, a real power grab. And we're seeing it, as I said, in so many different areas, and not only in politics. And it really is quite, it's really quite painful to watch, because I believe that we are such a cultured society, an educated society, yet I'm finding it, you know, difficult to understand why people are actually getting any traction out of this. And again, I think it comes back to the fact of, you know, politics and power. We're watching a, as you say, play out in 2014. We're going to see a real battle in the state and Senate seats, Congress and Senate seats, where I think 2012, what we thought was intense and extreme, is going to be ratcheted up at least, you know, by a volume of 10, if not more, as people become more desperate and as power is being lost in some areas or where they think is being lost, and that control and grabbing that control, it's becoming quite frightening all the way around. You know, one of the things we were talking about and that you brought up earlier about, you know, from Ohio to the Air Force colonel, I was really surprised. I was doing a little research on that last night as well. And the Air Force actually had put out a brochure, and it's a sexual assault prevention and response brochure, and it advises victims to consider submitting to their attack. And I was astounded to see this. It may be advisable to submit than to resist, is what the guide suggests. If you are attacked, says the victim should make the decisions based on the circumstances behind their attack while being especially careful. And I don't understand why, you know, again, this comes back to why should anybody have to submit to this? Why would they even in a brochure ask their victim to submit instead of fight?
Well, I, as someone who's attended classes in women's, you know, personal security, personal safety, whatever, certainly there are times that they say, you know, if it's life and death, choose. You know what I mean? And
right.
So I do. Right. I know that one woman in my own city who was abducted, when they finally caught the person that abducted and killed her, said he had to kill her because she just would not stop resisting. And I think that sometimes when you're, I think that's a terribly harsh reality to have to face. And I really think the comments that I see in the literature about what is it about our culture that creates a rape culture? What is it that makes this kind of violence against women somehow acceptable? Or, as you mentioned, if they actually give in to it because they feel their life is in danger, if they don't, where they're suddenly denigrated as perpetrators in their own crime. Because the statistics say there are times to not fight, you know. And they also say there's times to fight. So example, an example of the opposite thing is don't ever get in a car and let him take you anywhere. Make him kill you where you stand, but don't go where he can torture you. You know?
Well, right.
These are just some of the vague realities, but yeah.
Well,
I don't think brochure say don't report it.
Well, what this brochure is, this is the Air Force, a branch of the military, their brochure for coworkers. This is not for outside of. This is basically for sexual assault in the workplace. You know, within the structure of the service branch of service itself. So again, I'm folding. I don't want to separate the two, but I think between outside and inside on a a facility or off a facility. But what I'm reading here is this is a guide, you know, to address your coworkers, your co-servicemen. And it's suggesting that the woman, you know, it may be advisable to submit than to resist. That's what I guess surprised me. So let me clarify the two there. I can completely understand that when you're out on the street and it's a complete stranger. But when it's a coworker, you know, in your own facility, and it's advising you to submit instead of resist, without a differentiation of those two.
Right, and isn't it interesting that there's even has to be this kind of conversation? That's the one that amazes me, you know, that here we are in the age of helicopter mothers, where they're afraid to let their child run, you know, ride the school bus. They're afraid to let them stand out in front of school and wait for a bus. They're afraid to have them, you know, taking them everywhere rather than letting them use public transportation. All this safety for children. And then when adults fall prey to that dangerous world from which we protect our children, somehow they're now culpable. And I don't get, where did that leap happen? When did the helicopter land? You know what I mean? When did we stop being a village about this? And ultimately, coming back a little bit to what we were talking about earlier, if this is a matter of power, and if it's especially a matter of political power, which of course is part of what interests the Coffee Party audience, who's paying the toll? For whom is this a benefit? You know, that we, where does that work out? In my research, you know, there are various groups that, you know, go after various aspects of women's variety, you know, their share or their access or their ability to participate in American society. One of them that just freaks me out, of course, is the whole access to medical science. Like, medical science exists, but if you're a woman, you can only access certain parts of it. You know, reproductive health is not a part we want you to get to. Now, who benefits from that? Well, there's a group called Americans United for Life, and they're a major lobby group who were anti-abortion back in the days when Roe v. Wade was still being discussed, right? Not surprising that a group like this would develop. Not surprising that they have their perspective. I think it was very Catholic-oriented in the beginning, and definitely faith-based, sorry. But come today, and given Tea Party alliances, given Koch brother cash, given Citizens United, you know, they're now a fashionable, highly financed, and highly effective group. They're no longer the crusaders they once were. They're now in the groove and joining forces with other political maneuverers to bring their message to fruition, right? And they're not going to do it by enrolling people in not terminating pregnancies or supporting people who don't terminate pregnancies. They're going to do it by making it impossible to terminate a pregnancy, even if your life depends on it. And
exactly.
I don't know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, no. So I'm interested in how do people not see, sometimes I want to know how they do not see the connection between the Citizens United decision and dark money contributions and the power of this movement to take us back, not only in pre-Roe v. Wade, although that is Americans United for Life, that is their goal, to reverse Roe v. Wade. But frankly, there are the guys who cling on, jump on this bandwagon, and I swear they're taking us back to the 1400s. And I expect to see somebody burned at the stake, you know, for having feminist views or believing that women, which means you think women are equal, you know, that
I think this goes to a larger, you know, a larger discussion on the whole here about the suppression of minorities, whether they be women, whether they be women, you know, black, brown, Asian, it doesn't matter, color, gender, orientation. As a group that sees its power start to slip away, we see it with voter suppression, we see if there's any way to suppress a minority that is actually on par or will soon become a majority. We're seeing just little bits and pieces here where it's chipping away in different areas where we start to suppress that vote. We put that, again, coming back to the other, we dehumanize that group, make them the other, and push the belief that they do not have the right to be equal, to be human, to vote, to have a choice, to have equal, you know, whether it be pay, healthcare, or whatever it might be. It's a long game to suppress as much as you possibly can on a group or groups of people that will not necessarily vote your beliefs. So we see this in, you know, a lot of different areas, but most especially I think now with women, and it's really quite sad, because as we were discussing again last night, talking about young children, you know, young adults, you know, teens are not being taught to respect, you know, the female, the feminine. The masculine is the one that always leads. The feminine is the one that always follows. And, you know, when I was growing up at a time in my, I'm 55 years old, and so I'm in the 70s growing up out in Los Angeles and on the coast and on the beach. You know, I was during that time of the 60s and 70s, and there was a lot more openness. But we were taught in class, you know, we were taught sexual education in class, and we were taught to respect, and we were taught to be safe, and we were taught to, you know, have an open mind, yet at the same time, you know, be responsible for our actions. And I think young adults are no longer being taught that, and we're seeing laws that are being submitted in certain states right now, where they're looking to change that at a state level, not just a county level, but change, you know, sexual education at a state level and make it illegal to teach sexual education. And these conversations are not happening, you know, with young children, with young adults, so that they have an idea of what they are dealing with, you know, as they mature. And we end up seeing the violence that happened, as an example, in Steubenville, where
yes.
Steubenville, you know, the young woman was vilified for coming out and, you know, naming the two names of the young boys that had, while she was passed out, while she was, you know, completely passed out, that she was actually the perpetrator and those two young boys were the victims.
Now, right,
what's even more surprising is that the football coach, who was supposed to be a mentor and a leader, you know, in the town and in the culture there, actually had, and he tried to cover up and suppress the information, what had happened to these two boys, just recently had his contract renewed. And I'm surprised, again, there's been no recourse or repercussion for this kind of behavior. So when young adults see this happen with their older adults, you know, their peers, and the adult in society having absolutely no recourse or repercussion, not recourse, but repercussion for their actions, there's no reason why they should follow, you know, the rule of the law. They're just following what they see.
Right. I find it very interesting that the harassment campaign for that particular victim started out, though, in social media. And mm-hmm. It spread to mainstream media, but it started on Facebook. It started on, you know what I'm saying, kids
right.
slamming this young girl. And to me, that points to the success. If there's a campaign to keep women in second citizen status, you know, to keep them out of power and influence, that
right.
shows me that it's successful. Because truly, first of all, why would the mainstream media pick up anything social media did? Hello? I mean, come listen to Lunch with Loudon, you guys, or come listen, you know, go to Coffee Party USA on Facebook and report some of what you see there. But no. It's easy, it's fun, it's sensational, and it's confirming to a particular social moray that we keep in place, and the spin doctors keep it in place. And
mm-hmm.
there has to be a gain for that. I want to take just a second, though. There are folks in chat. There are folks listening on the telephone, and no one is raising their hand or asking questions. So the number to call in is 646-929-2495, and you have to press 1 to raise your hand. Otherwise, I don't know you want to speak. And, of course, questions in chat I'll bring to those of us on the air. So thanks, and I'll come back to you now, Dennis. So this social campaign or the spin doctors don't work for free, right?
Right.
And they tend to be associated with think tanks. This man who made the devastating statement about we don't want people to vote, even way back in the 80s, he was from the Heritage Foundation. You hear interesting words come out of ALEC conventions. Is it really as simple as we don't want you to vote, therefore we're going to separate you from the herd as much as we can? It's certainly true for other groups. Is it also true for women? I see that someone has raised their hand. If you'd like to answer before I take a caller, that's great, or we could bring in and see if our caller has a question.
Well, I think what you were, you know, really quickly, I think you're correct in that there is a concerted long-term effort here. There is a long-term game to suppress as many minorities and as many different people than one specific group. I remember the comment by that religious leader and not wanting people to vote. We don't want everybody to vote. There's a group that wants to be able to control the vote. If you control the vote, then you can control where the money goes, where the money lies, who gets the contracts, who gets what, where, when, and how. I really agree with that. I think that there is an immense amount of money, as we see, in politics. There's money to be made, you know, with the money in politics. It's become another source of income and cash and revenue for quite a few. It's become very profitable. And as long as your profit stream, your revenue stream is either increased or uninhibited, then you win. And that's really the long term and the long game for many in this group now.
Right, right. And you throw into that the Lawrence Lessig's belief that not solving issues generates cash. You know, so
mm-hmm.
whether you're for or against, whether you're conservative, progressive, it doesn't matter. You bring money to your
mm-hmm.
campaign coffers as long as these issues are not resolved. And I feel the longer we wait to resolve some of them, the more likely we are to get gunny bag results. But I'll tell you what, I'll bring in our caller from area code 707. Your mic is live. Welcome to Lunch with Loudon.
Hi, this is Linda.
Hey, Linda.
From Northern California. Interesting topic. I don't think it's an easy one answer topic, but there's a couple things that I feel play into it. I'm a victim of sexual military abuse, so I don't come at it from this angle. I was in the Navy, and we did have those little. This was back in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the little, what do they call it? Some kind of a sexual abuse, mandatory thing where we all had to get together and listen to this guy and watch a movie or something. I forget what you call it now. But anyway, we had that. And they did put out the idea that in certain circumstances, it might be good to submit. It didn't say to your cap or anything like that. I think that was the things that they were using were probably for the general public, not necessarily for the military. So in certain circumstances, you know, if somebody's going to kill you, then your life is primary. So that, you know, I can see where that probably was used.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that a lot of the, it was kind of a joke. Oh, we have to go to this thing, you know, and it was a big joke. And, you know, the mentality was still there, even after this mandatory thing. So that tells me that it goes way back. I mean, when you're raising a kid, you have to implant certain morals and things like that, and if you do a good job, hopefully, no matter what society hopefully does, that's going to still stick with that child. And if that's changing, then I don't know. I worry about our society, basically, that we can't raise moral kids. I mean, you know, Grant, I agree with what you say about you cut me in the middle of eating my Cheerios. I raised my hand too fast.
Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. But, you know, the sexual education classes in high school and whatnot,
right.
Those classes, everything is getting, that was my other point, was I think things are getting very religion is definitely coming to play in a big part in a lot of these decisions, maybe more so in certain areas of the country, like, say, the Bible Belt and whatnot. But I think it comes to play in a lot of places, even in New Hampshire, where you wouldn't call that the Bible Belt.
No.
We had a certain element of people that would come in and push for, you know, these same kind of, oh, we don't want to talk about this. We just, you know, abstinence only, you know, preaching God and all this kind of stuff, which had no place in school. And I'm not anti-religion by any long stretch, but it's just, I think it has its place. And it's gotten so overblown out of its place. And there's a lot of money there, too, because then I start thinking, well, maybe we should start taxing the churches. Because, you know, they're getting pretty powerful if they can start influencing such basic cultural norms to the point where their message becomes primary over the Constitution. I have a real big problem with that.
Well, you know, it's interesting what you just said, because whether it's a matter of faith or gender or race or, hey, what part of the country you're from. I mean, it always amazed me that everybody gets all misty about September 11th, and yet most people hate New York. What is that? You know, there's a lot of...
Coming from New Jersey, I understand that very well.
Exactly. I mean, New York needs help. New Jersey needs help. I mean, they don't even like New York, and yet there's just been so much well-done spin to have something they don't like, or the attack on something they don't like. Anyway, that's for a whole other show. But do you feel, I mean, for example, tolerating the, oh, my God, we have to go to the sexual harassment seminar. I mean, as an employer, anybody that said that when we, you know, because we did it periodically, right? Anybody that said that got to come talk to me. You know, I want you to understand why we're doing this. It wasn't like I didn't bring them in to chew them out. I really wanted to know why this was a problem. You know, sincerely, why is this a problem? And every time I had that conversation with someone, it came around to, well, it's not really. I understand your perspective, but it's kind of like the thing to say. And I think it becomes very dangerous when we allow the thing to say, like we allowed social media to annihilate this young girl in Ohio.
Well,
when you were
from in the Navy. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going
to
say,
sure,
you know, when you were, talking about, I wanted to go back to a couple of topics that you were talking about, being in the Navy and having to go to these classes, and even today, you had mentioned that you were in the service a while ago. Even today, I mean, you still go to these classes. The Navy, the Air Force, all branches of service have these classes. But if there is any violence that is perpetrated upon you as an example, you are not, you are not encouraged to come out and speak against it because it will damage your career. It could damage the officer's career. It could damage the other soldier's career. And there's a suppression culture there within the military to suppress any type of reporting of this kind of violence. There was a recently on another page, there's a Facebook page. You were just talking about social media. There's a Facebook page promoting violence against female Marines. And Rep Jackie Spear, who is a Democrat out of California, publicly brought that to attention to the Secretary of Defense. And they shut it down for a short while. The page is back up again. And it's mocking not only, you know, women, the violence against women, but it's also mocking Congress. And the idea that these pages, you know, are able to appear at all and this violence continues. And I think, again, this comes back to, you know, what are we teaching our youth today? Are we teaching them to respect women? And, you know, this lack of education is carrying over into the military. And so it comes right back to what are we teaching our youth today? How are we, you know, how are we as good parents, as good citizens, teaching our children and modeling, you know, good behavior that they follow upon? It's not happening. And as you were saying, I think as a culture, it's really starting to chip away, and it's starting to, we're losing that humanity. We're losing that soul of our great culture, because when this starts to fall, when you start to tear this apart, the whole culture has to follow. And we're walking a demise.
Well, and I'm interested, Dennis and Linda, what you think about this, but when things show up in our youth, I mean, I'm assuming we're all parents, maybe we're not, but my kids certainly expressed things and did things they did not learn at home. And so mm-hmm. the whole idea that parents are totally responsible for what their kids say or what their kids do is kind of a joke, but they are totally accountable. I want to make that clear. I felt totally accountable for my children, regardless of where they picked up whatever they picked up. It amazes me that in society, you know, we continue these denigrating conversations about women. We mock sexual harassment training. We actually, the whole thing about women warriors being subject to sexual assault is just, and the fact that we can't get much done about that, you know, other than a bunch of rhetoric and a few press conferences, really points to there's just more lies about supporting the troops. You know, we got all these lies, but when people buy in, kids are like this barometer of what is the buzz and what are the mores that are coming up and how successful is the spin. You know, because I promise you, the spin doctors are not in for the short term. They're in for the long game. And so my biggest concern is, why does it serve big money to invest in the technology and the manpower and the effort to create spin that is anti your faith, anti your gender, anti your socioeconomic status? You know, what is this parsing of society into a billion pieces accomplishing for the people who pay for that? Why there has to be a strategy. They wouldn't waste their money on it.
Well, I think you just said the last part of it there. It's about money. It's really about controlling the most amount of money in the fewest and least amount of hands. And if you, again, come back to dehumanizing and turning somebody into anything other than a human being, you've stolen their power. And by stealing their power, you're able to suppress. And by suppressing them, you're able to continue the path that you're down of creating and generating more revenue and income for whoever it might be. I really think this is, you know, it all comes down to money, as you were saying earlier. How do I suppress this group of people? How do I keep them underneath the boot or keep them down to a point that I can take whatever income they have or part of their income or shave back their income and generate higher revenue for whatever industry, you know, vertical that I may be in right now? How do I continue to generate more money? That's really all we've come down to as a culture. We are, you know, we are a consuming culture these days. And how do we consume more money, more things, more toys, more items? You know, it really is, how do we generate more money?
Well, we have another caller to bring in on this conversation. I'm going to leave Linda and Dennis. I'll leave your mic 5, and I'm going to bring in area code 620. Area code 620, welcome to Lunch with Loudon.
This is Jack Golding.
Oh, Jack,
hi,
hello.
Okay, whole problem boils down to this. Preschool, you got to learn from the age of 2 or 3 how to get along with each other. And this business of cutting out on Head Start, doing away with Head Start. Head Start, I guess, is the closest thing to what I realize is pre-K for all kids. Education boils out of that. The parents cannot be completely responsible for everything because they don't know. Boil down to competent teachers, nursery school teachers, that will educate even the poorest from age 2 or 3 to the age of 5 or 6. It's critical. At age 7, they should have sex education because once they're aware of their body, I think that affects abortions. They could reduce abortions to close to 0. Not a need to have that, all that stuff trying to life and conception and all of that.
All right. Well, I do think it's interesting that the things that we believe and I think are pretty well documented in the literature that contribute to someone's ability to be a productive citizen, to be and to live out their own potential is early education. And
yes,
as a matter of fact, the United Nations has taken a position that educate all women so they can educate their children, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
and the world will change. And yet, why? What's the benefit? Why does it benefit somebody for that not to happen? Why are people not only fighting preschool education, but want to privatize education, you know, by their vilifying public ed? And so what's the payoff? Because, you know, no one's going to really say that any of this social manipulation is about money and politics until we can connect the dots for them.
It's ignorance. That's what it is. Basically, a lot of these corporate people like the Koch brothers and G and all those reasons, that they're ignoramuses. They may be smart, smartly stupid, and stupidly smart. people dodge issues by asking a question from a question.
Well, may I bring up a point here?
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, sure, Jack. You bring up a real interesting point. I wanted to get, you know, I'm glad you brought this up because I wanted to get to it as well. You were talking
about... You're the guest, right?
Yes, this is
Dennis
Little.
Yes.
Sounds familiar.
Nah, I don't know where we would have met, but I'm sure I'm out there somewhere.
I don't know where we met, but the name sounds familiar.
You were talking about preschool, and you were talking about young boys. And young boys, I think, are not taught today to really respect women and girls and the female gender itself, like I was taught when I was younger. And again, the modeling from father down to mother down to son somewhere is becoming disconnected in there through education as well. I have friends of mine that, you know, they're, when they interact with their young sons, the mothers that interact with their young boys in a way that is loving, nurturing, respectful, they model that back to women. For the most part, I've seen that happen. I've seen friends of mine, male friends of mine, do the same thing. They show a distinct and loving respect for the women in their lives, and then their sons, their children, start to reflect that back as well. They're watching their fathers do this. I've seen fathers, again, friends of mine, fathers who interact with their boys, and they've got a very macho, very aggressive, very, you know, forward, in-your-face kind of attitude towards their spouses, and their sons start to reflect that back after a while. And so I think that there's, you know, at a very young age, you know, changing that belief of and nurturing that, you know, that loving respect for, you know, the opposite sex starts with, you know, a mother and father reflecting that back down. And for some reason, that's being lost as well.
Well, back in my generation, boys, say, from the age of 6 or something like that, just instinctively are taught to be hostile. To be hostile towards girls. Girl, back up to the time, and I was taught to, I was probably just prejudiced myself. When I was in high school, maybe it's shyness or maybe it's what the hell it is to avoid, be hostile or avoid contact with the opposite sex until I was 19, before I had my first date, and that was to the junior college prom in my sophomore year in college, right, junior college in Chicago.
And you also make a good point, Jack, that, you know, you really need to work with people, men, boys, girls, whatever, before they get goofy hormones. when they get goofy hormones, which is their job, right, and when they become a little bit irrational, which is also their job, and when they're in that stage of trying to sort of test the limits and test their parents and test society, which is also their job, you know, they've got this unspoken consciousness going forth with them that still has limits. You know, they're not at risk of killing people, that they're not at risk of raping people, that they're not at risk of stealing from people. I mean, those kind of fundamental things happen quite young. And the thing that I see a shift, I mean, I'm in my 60s. Jack, you're in your 80s.
You're still in your 50s?
I'm in my 50s. Dennis just said he's 55. And Laura is timeless. Or Linda is timeless. But I feel this recent trend to tolerate prejudices. It could be against women. It could be against another faith. It could be against another race. It could be, you know, but it's almost like we tolerate or teaching our kids to tolerate other people's prejudices so that we don't have to confront our own. So there's kind of this mob mentality that says political correctness is oppressive. And yet the real political correctness anymore, if you go by the standard definition, truly politically correct these days is believing there's a war on Christmas. You know what I'm saying? I mean, seriously. And the vilification of the term political correctness tells us that somebody out there, Right.
I vilify
so somebody
that.
Out there has some dog in the fight. They don't want society to evolve in towards equality, towards social justice, and towards these things that I think when I read the Join the Coffee Party Movement Facebook page, the things I see people striving for, kind of this evolved society where we've transcended so many of our differences and seek to build on what we have in common. We have to tolerate bigotry around us to keep it ourselves, even if we're not even bigoted about the same things. And I think, I don't know what to do to counter this anti-political correctness thing, because the term political correct is totally sabotaged. But all I think we were trying to say was that humanity, the unification of humanity, is a human goal. And I used to think all religions actually sought that. So what did I stir up in any of the three of you?
Well, I think you also... Go ahead.
All right, I'm going to call on Dennis. Oh, Linda, go for it.
I'm sorry. I didn't realize that. Well, I was just going to say, when you're talking about who has the money in this fight, I would say if you look at some of the areas where women are denigrated in the whole genre of gaming, my son's a programmer, or he tries to be, and there's a big thing where women who are programmers don't really want to write for a lot of these games because the women are sexified. They're, you know, this whole idea of needing to be rescued by the man. You know, you can't be a strong female, and they turn them into kind of like bimbos. And it's just there's money to be made in that, and it's a big business, and I don't know how far it goes or anything like that, but I know that's an aspect of where money could come into some of this, and it propagates the idea, you know, to young people that are playing games that this is the way it really is. And, you know, as far as the political correctness, I don't know. I'll be 60 in August, so I'm not timeless. I would say that maybe political correctness is kind of like you have to drag society kicking and screaming with certain rules that they don't particularly like. But after a while, it becomes the norm versus anything goes, and then that becomes the norm. You know, you kind of get acclimated to it, and after a while, you don't think twice. You would never think back of going back and saying some of the things they said before this political correctness movement, you know. I don't know. That's just my idea.
Well, political correctness wasn't really a movement. It was a name given to people striving for social justice and for respect and dignity in speaking and language rather than, you know, it's why we don't use the N-word, you know, it's why we don't, I mean, there's,
right.
And it became politically correct as a way of denigrating this movement, I believe. And Dennis, you're about to say something.
Well, what you were talking about, you know, since the 60s and 70s, we have fought so hard for equality. Across,
yes.
You know, all gender and all race and all orientation lines for 40 to 50 years now. And it seems that it is just within a few years, the acceleration to dial that back and to strip those gains away is gaining a lot of traction in a very short period of time. And it's really painful to watch because, as we hear out on radio, you know, there was a Sandra Fluke who really
yes.
was just fighting
yeah.
for, you know, who was just fighting for the right to be able to purchase birth control, you know, at a very reduced rate, or have her insurance given for free. And she was immediately vilified in a way of turning her into a sexual opposite and really putting her down and denigrating her humanity again as a woman. And it was very violent in the way it was being played out in the media. You know, there was one particular talk show host that just went to task on her and, again, had no right to, really no right to do that. She didn't, yeah, she didn't deserve that type of behavior. But that mouthpiece has such a large audience and as easily manipulates, you know, the people that do listen to the show. And they buy into it, and one, you know, leads to another. The dominoes start to fall, and there's an accelerated. Now, there's a great backlash against him for that. But at the same time, you know, as that dies down, that energy dies down, it slowly starts to creep back in again, and then slowly starts to get ramped up again. And
All I was going to say is, you know, the thing I want to contrast with that is, you know, Edward R. Murrow could challenge somebody's beliefs and never denigrate them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a lost art. We don't have to agree. But somehow disagreement and denigration have become, those distinctions have become collapsed. And it has to be to somebody's benefit, because it's certainly not to society's benefit. So anyway, sorry to have interrupted.
Okay.
Well, I would...
Can I say something here? All right.
Well, please do, Jack.
The member was Rush Limbaugh, and I'm really concerned about the old guys like Ted Cruz, and they say something that's immigration or anti something or other, and you've got people who are followers of that, of the extreme right, Tea Party gals, Tea Party people mainly, and they call the what I can't tolerate is getting these people applauding that stuff. I call it the dog whistle crowd. And that may be as much as 5% of the voting population, I would guess.
No idea.
Would be up the extreme right. I don't know if I agree with that percentage, but I'm assuming that's a set percentage. Then you got a few on the extreme left that won't tolerate anything that's moderately conservative. That's maybe 2% of the population, 1% of the population. I don't think the Move On organization would be of the extreme left, something like that. And I don't think they're about as intolerant as the extreme right. Let me close with this argument. Walter Winchell in 1942 said, the only thing, it's a paraphrase, FDR for freedom of speech, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. The only thing we have to hate is hate, and the only thing we have to be intolerant of is intolerance. Think about that.
Brilliant, Jack, and perfect timing, because we're coming to the end of our time.
Yeah,
and
right.
I want to thank you for that contribution. I'm going to make a little poster out of that one. I will. Linda, any words before we close our time together?
No, I think it's theater. A lot of the media that we have now is just theater, and that plays to our lower mentality. What do you call it? The worst side of our natures, and we just have to get away to that. Putting women in power would definitely bring out the better side of our natures, in my feminist opinion.
Excellent.
That's it.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Jack, and thank you, Linda. I wanted to let my audience know we're going to run a few minutes over time today because I'd like to complete this conversation with our guest, Dennis Little. So, Dennis, where are you with this conversation at this point in time?
I actually, there's so much more to talk about, and I wish we had,
we
could go on for hours, because it really, there's so many threads that come out of this and move into different areas, and then they all tie back around to the center once again. But I think what really has to happen here is the dialogue again, the conversation that we're not having. And it seems that we're being separated. My work has, for the last 12 years, has been, you know, reaching across the aisle and bringing people to the center of the room to dialogue respectfully, regardless of ideology or belief. And when we do that, we find we have more in common than what divides us. And it is a difficult job to really get people to come together and speak and put away the, as you were saying earlier, you know, having a dialogue and being able to, you know, to find a common ground instead of a winner-take-all belief and attitude, which is what is happening, and I see this happening more and more across our own society and culture. It's, you know, winner-take-all, and there is no compromise. There is no common ground. There is no healthy debate. You know, and it's this is just one area that of many that needs to be addressed today, and I think it needs to be addressed at all levels, you know, of society and all points of life. You know, from early childhood to, you know, young years to adult years, and, you know, realize that, you know, we all have our humanity. We are all one, and, you know, we either rise together or we fall together. There is no group that will continue to be on top, because eventually they will lose that place as well. So,
well, and obviously Coffee Party USA agrees with that position totally, that we believe that sit down at the table, have a cup of coffee, talk to one another person to person, and we will find common ground, at least enough to move forward. And I agree with what you've been saying about the need for dialogue, because I don't think society is an accident, right? I think it's
no.
A conscious move. I think societies consciously evolve, or subconsciously. Someone is driving, there's some need that's driving it, there are forces that drive a culture in a particular direction. And the American culture has been shifting. And I spent a day once in the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., most of that day in the propaganda exhibit that showed so clearly how people will change in order to survive. And I feel like a lot of the stuff that's going on now is shifting the conversation of survival. So just like in post-World War I Germany, people were starving. Their money was worthless. They had no industry, and the world didn't care. And what they did was find a way to rescue themselves. And to, well, frankly, we had World War II because we didn't give a darn about what happened to Germany after World War I. And I think that same understanding applies to people today. When you take away their jobs, when you take away their homes, when you take away their dignity, people try to find a way to survive. But they don't survive as the way this is being done in America. We're not surviving together as an extended family, or our society is becoming fragmented, societies within a society, instead of our all coming together. So based on our conversation today and the things that we've been talking about to lead up to the show today, it is painfully clear to me that this, what's the word? When you know, this parsing of America into
right.
little bitty groups totally blocks our power as a nation. and leaves what power remains in the hands of those few that that control the narrative that defines our society. And so I'm very interested in reclaiming the narrative, which is why I'm a part of the Be the Media Project. And I'm very interested in having these ongoing conversations, which is why I'm talking to you today, Dennis, and was to Linda and Jack, and our listeners on Lunch with Loudon. We cannot passively change this. We can't sit back and hope, people knock it off. It's not going to happen. That's not how societies evolve. Every one of us needs to stand up and say, this is not okay with me. This is not the America I seek. I believe in American ingenuity, and it can't happen when we're fragmented, right? So,
oh, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. I'm actually looking forward. You and I are both remember that the demonstrations that used to happen across this country, the anti-war mm-hmm. demonstrations and mm-hmm. the equal rights demonstrations. And I'm actually looking forward to the day again when people start to come together and stand up and stand aligned and side by side and said, we will not allow this to happen anymore. We will not allow this to happen. I'm looking for it nonviolent, but I would also like to hear people screaming, from the tops of buildings that we will not allow this to happen anymore. And people come together, stand side by side, regardless, again, of belief. And that we will not be suppressed. You will not suppress my daughter. You will not suppress my mother. You will not suppress my gay son. You will not suppress my next door neighbor who happens to be a different color than me. We will not allow this. I stand beside them. I'm looking forward to those days again when we come together as a single nation to say, we will become whole again. We will not be dictated to. We will not be told what to think, what to believe. We are better than this. We are a better society. So I'm really looking forward to those days once again.
Oh, brilliant, Dennis. Thank you so much. It's a perfect completion for our show. And I want to thank you again to our listeners. This is Dennis Little, and he's into transformation at a political level, transpartisan politics, and making a difference in the world. And Dennis, you just made a difference in my world. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure, and I really enjoyed being here today.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. All right.
So I'll close, as I always do, with a few reminders. One of them is that Be the Media has more shows than Lunch with Loudon, Mondays at 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern. Oh, Dan Aronson, Press One for Democracy, although I stand corrected, he's now moved his show to 6 p.m. Pacific and 9 p.m. Eastern. Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, conservative Michael Charney and progressive Eric Beiler host The Middle Ground. Thursdays, of course, Lunch with Loudon, 12 noon Pacific. Saturdays, 10 a.m. Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, Roberto Willis is the host of Politics Done Right. That is an open mic show. He might start with the direction, but I'll tell you, the man will go anywhere you want to go with him. He's brilliant. And last but not least, Coffee Party USA is a grassroots organization funded totally by our members. Citizens United has not benefited us. If you like the show or anything you see Coffee Party doing these days, become a member by going to www.coffeepartyusa.com. There's going to be a big Join Now button, or there'll be a Donate button. You can become a member for as little as $30, or you can join me and be a sustaining member where you have a little bit taken out every month, and that begins at $5 per month. We haven't had a $1,000 per month donor yet, but maybe that's you. That could be you. I believe in all possibilities. So until next week, I want to thank everyone for joining us. This has been an interesting and thought-provoking conversation, and I am so ready. Coffee party on.